All right, hello. How is everyone today?
Morning.
Good.
All right. So I think you hopefully have gotten an email from me, from us, the core staff, yesterday. So we have extended the deadline for Shell Lab until Monday, March the 30th. So that gives you several more days. And this is kind of in consideration of some folks who have been set back by things like having to, change everything, moving jobs, all the kind of stuff that has kind of come up unexpectedly recently. We still do, think it's important for you to get through this and learn a lot from it. So please continue to make progress daily, and we want to make sure you have a chance to make it to the end. Shell Lab is probably the most important thing that we'll have you do in this course. It's what will, knowledge of processes and fork and file input output. All this stuff is going to be very important to your operating systems class and all kinds of other things in the future. So that's why we got to get this in. And of course, it'll be a big part of your final exam also. So y'all need this, and I'm glad that we've been seeing folks at help hours on Zoom. Let's keep you moving forward. Let us know what you're getting stuck on. We'll get you moving forward. So that deadline change should be shown in Autolab, and so that's nothing big changes there. What are your questions about Shell Lab? So, while you think about that, I've put this CPU memory gap graph. I've left that kind of on the screen from where we were getting started last class. So there's kind of a lot in here, and it did stimulate some discussion among y'all. So I'll leave it up. There's kind of a lot to look at. We started off by talking about memory in computer systems, and that's really what's driving this. Although the memory is just kind of one part, one among many things on this graph. So DRAM is kind of the main memory we're used to looking at. But we're also talking about, in the context of a whole system where we have a CPU processor executing instructions and a disk storing things permanently. So the memory, of course, is only contains things while the computer's powered on, so it's sort of temporary in that way. So memory by itself is not useful without a disk to get data from initially, but then also we need a processor to actually do things. So just looking at this one more time, if we see in approximately 1985, these processor and memory are very close to the same speed. So that kind of that works out. Each of them can do millions of things per second, which we would often measure in megahertz at that time. So your memory can provide instructions to the processor at almost the same rate. But over time, and this has been a pretty steady trend, and I think someone asked before, well, where's 2020 on this graph? Well, it's not there, but I can assure you that there aren't going to be any dramatic changes in this as there haven't been for the previous 30 years. So none of these lines are going to cross each other. Their relative positions will stay the same, and if anything, they just separate further. CPUs have gotten, drastically faster. For a long time, it was just in number of cycles per second in megahertz, and then later gigahertz. And then since the mid 2000s, the cycles per second haven't really changed, but the amount of cores on a chip and computation, effective computation per second, has. So if you were asking, some folks were curious about what's the difference between CPU cycle time and effective CPU cycle time. Well, this is saying that even though, so, you know, our processors now have more cores, even if each core is only doing 2 billion, a mere 2 billion things per second, that still adds up, you know, four of those adds up to 8 billion instructions per second. So that's effective CPU time. There is a side in the text in chapter 6 about that specific question. So in this graph itself is in chapter 6 in our text. Please do check it out to sort of fill out your background info on memory and caches. We're not having you go through all of chapter 6. I can pick it up here. So we're having you go up to the first few sections, up to 6.3, I think is what it says in the schedule. So we're getting you all the principles of caching and memory hierarchy, and which is really what you need to build on, especially going forward. It really explains so much about how our programs perform and how they work at all and how systems are designed at all. You know, going further in chapter 6, in sections 4 and 5, they go into much more detail, which ends up being pretty difficult, as you have to kind of compute a lot of things about specific cache performance that we're not going that deep into. So don't be too scared if you see these, like, you know, there are some like pretty difficult problems at the end of chapter 6. So, but we're going to stick with the basic principles. But you will need that, you know, we will go into this to some extent on your next exam. And it sort of underlies so many things about how systems work. Going back to, as you saw, our first intro lab when we had you run in time performance of programs. And this is like one of the main things that computer scientists do is, you know, research the behavior of our computers and how they perform, and speed is a big part of that. So I know a number of you sounded kind of interested in computer hardware, so this provoked some questions and thoughts. What else have you thought of looking at this graph here? So let's move forward and talk about how to solve this, because we have a dilemma here, and that is as I brought up in our last class, our processors can do billions of things per second, but those instructions come from main memory, which is orders of magnitude slower, you know, 10 times or 100 times slower. So what is the point of this super fast processor if it can't even get those instructions fast enough? That's the big dilemma. And that's, fortunately there's a solution. Otherwise our computers would be, you know, about as slow as they were 25 years ago. And, we'd have no point to these fast processors. So there is a solution. And, so we will, address that today. And the first way we'll do that is introducing a term to you called locality. So that is our the concept that solves this CPU memory performance or speed gap. So what does this word mean? This is kind of a general idea or a principle, and we'll say that the definition we use here is that programs, it's a tendency, a trend, and it tends to hold pretty often. Programs tend to use data and instructions located near or in the same place as those used recently. So I say located, I mean the address is the location in memory of any data, whether it's an instruction for a program or it's data for a program. So, And of course, you've kind of seen all of this firsthand. The instruction pointer is just an address where the next instruction lies, and the move instructions move data from this in your experience as assembly language programmers and in reverse engineering and debugging programs in this class. So we have two types of locality, to be more specific. So first, we'll talk about temporal locality. So temporal meaning, in recently in time. So again, in the near future. So things, information in programs gets reused. Again, we're talking about both data and instructions. So things get reused repeatedly, and typically things that were used recently are more likely to get used again soon. And you can kind of, well, we can show you many examples of this, but this also sort of holds in a lot of things, even in sort of the physical world, things that you have worked on recently. And I often think about this in the context of, say, the desk of a busy person. And I think some of you have even seen that, I have a desk if I'm ever in the room 335 in the math building, a desk with lots of stuff on it, paper and things, computers I'm trying to fix, stuff like that. And sometimes things get buried under there, and someone will say, well, gee, how can you function like this? But there is this tendency that something I'm working on today, if I leave it on top of my desk, that's like what's on the top of the pile. And when I come back tomorrow, it's a lot more likely that I'm going to want to look at what I was looking at the day before and not something on the bottom of the pile, which has probably been there for weeks. And like, if I haven't looked at it for weeks, like how important is it that I really look at it tomorrow? So a lot of things in our physical world also adhere to this idea of like, well, if you used it recently, you're more likely to use it again. If something has been sitting untouched for a long time, means it's probably not relevant right now anyway. So, I think you can also, I can think of another metaphor, but we'll get to that when we do CS Illustrated coming up later today. The other type of locality is spatial locality. Items with nearby addresses close near each other in space. Of course, usually we mean spatial in this like physical way of things being near each other, but in the computer memory, we're talking about addresses near each other, which actually there is a certain physical like way that the memory is laid out on a chip. In any case, items with addresses near each other tend to be referenced close together in time. And so this is like, whatever is at this position in memory here that I'm pointing at, it's the next thing to happen, whether that's like an instruction or a data access, is more likely to be like nearby, like say the next thing in memory, like the next entry in an array, the next instruction in a program, much more likely than something way further away in memory. So things tend to happen in order. So that's leads to spatial locality being, a principle that we see pretty often. So are these ideas like consistent with what you've seen in programs or other parts of the world? Thank you, Andres. Seeing some emoji in the chat. Cool. We'll go into some specific examples in computer code, but these are kind of good principles and good things to keep in mind. These are probably ideas that you're aware of, even if you didn't call it locality. So, some examples in programs. So we're gonna have little snippets of source code to look at here. And hopefully these will sort of remind you of things you've seen before, things like loops and arrays that you should have pretty good familiarity with at this point. So, here are four lines of C code, which is probably actually also valid Java code for that matter. This is all very normal construction with a for loop. So we're going to discuss the locality here. So this is something that we can kind of talk about in relative terms, that certain programs exhibit this idea of locality or utilize this better than others. So we can kind of, in a qualitative way, say, oh, this is better locality than that, or here is a good example of locality or a not so good example. So let's break this into two categories, references to data and references to instructions. So that you know, those are the main portions of what drives this program here. So as you have seen, even things like sum equals zero, this line in C is going to be turned into machine instructions by a compiler. So we would we would see the output of the compiler in assembly as saying, like, move the value zero to some location in memory, and then, you know, from there into a register if it's going to be directly used. So there's this thing sum that starts at zero and has things added to it. And then there's this for loop that goes through an array called A. It goes through some indices in the array represented by I, and I is going to go from zero to increasing by one every time to some value n, which we're not worried about exactly how large that is. But again, you've worked with arrays plenty of times. It can be small or large. This loop will go through n of them and then do an addition each time through the loop. So all of these things, again, we saw earlier in this course that this for loop really turns into, a conditional jump based on this test. And then there's an add instruction and another check for a conditional jump. Does it jump back again? All that. I think hopefully you can now imagine how this turns into raw instructions for a processor. And not only can you imagine it, but you know how to use, say, GCC or a compiler to turn this into instructions, and we could actually just look and see exactly what they are. Anyway, so we can talk about instructions, we can talk about data. I guess we'll start with data, which is kind of the first place. I think we're a lot more used to thinking about things like sum and A than we are about the instructions. So we are going to have array elements in succession. So as this for loop progresses, this thing A, we're gonna see A of zero, A of one, A of two. You know, we can kind of go through in our head how I is gonna change. Pretty easy to see from this code. So each of these array elements will be accessed in order, A of zero, A of one, A of two. So each of these things is has its own address in memory, but we know that arrays are stored in order, adjacent to each other. So A of zero and A of one, we can even, you know, we could use, GDB or something to compute the addresses. We could use the address of operator. So A of zero and A of one, well, they're actually, how many bytes? They're 4 bytes apart, because we know n's are 4 bytes. So we would call this certain type of locality as we just defined. So this is going to be spatial locality. So each of those array accesses are close to each other. And in fact, A of one is close to A of zero, which was what just happened previous to that. And then after A of one is A of two. So they're happening in order and all right next to each other. So that is our example of spatial locality. Now we also have, in addition to accessing all those array elements, this thing sum, which started out as zero, that is repeatedly added to throughout this loop. So that is some location in memory that's modified repeatedly. So that is the same spot, that same address in memory, but it keeps changing. So that is going to be temporal locality. So there's our examples. And in this little tiny bit of code, there's really, those are the two bits of data. I guess you could say the array index I is also the third identifier there, but we're concerned with the sum and the array. So the question we have for you now is, you know, can you look at programs and evaluate their locality of different parts in this way? Well, we can also go on to instructions. So the parts of this that execute. So this is not quite as direct, but we can, since again, our experience using debugger and things like that, I think we can try and follow what's going to happen with the instructions here. And again, we also know how we could use GDB or something like that. We could actually just watch. Here's an instruction, next. And we could actually just kind of, you know, you could make a little diagram of like how, you know, what order the instructions went in. And in this case, each of the instructions here, like whatever this move instruction is and whatever, you know, checks happen for the for loop and this, you know, this happens repeatedly. So, and any of these programs, generally speaking, when there aren't a lot of jumps and other changes in control flow, these programs just kind of proceed in an order from top to bottom. So these instructions are usually happening in a sequence. And so that would be spatial locality. So that is, you know, the address of the instruction that after the one that just got executed is going to be in memory right after it. So that's spatial locality. And again, certain instructions, say in the middle of a loop, run repeatedly and right after, you know, immediately right after each other. So this instruction, this add instruction here, is at a certain location in memory that gets run over and over again. So that particular address in memory gets accessed repeatedly. So that is temporal locality. Just that same spot in a short amount of time later gets accessed again and again. So these are our two types of locality and some examples in this program here. What do you think? Could you, if we asked you today or in the future, if we asked you to look at a piece of code and say, well, is this good locality? You know, let's ask. Here's an example. Here's a little bit of code. It's a little bit more than we saw before. Some arrays, columns. So this is taking the two-dimensional array, also called A, taking the sum of everything in all of the columns and rows of this. So just going through all the items in this two-dimensional array and taking their sum. So similar to before, sum starts at zero. And now we have a for loop and another for loop inside. So this is where it gets a little bit more interesting. So, and this is not unusual at all. We see this in programs a lot. So let's try to answer specifically this array A. What is the access pattern here? How are these things getting accessed? So J starts at zero. I starts at zero. So the first access here starts at A of zero of zero. So we could just make a note of that. That's how we start, A of zero of zero. Now what's going to come next? Well, the next thing, this inner for loop, I gets incremented. So this whole for loop of I changing, I is going to go from zero to M, and that whole for loop has to finish before we get the next iteration of this outer loop. Have you done nested loops like this before? The next thing in this is going to be, if I goes from 0 to 1, the next thing is A of 1 of 0, and so on, A of 2 of 0, all the way up to whatever the maximum value for I is, some M. And then after that, J will increment from 0 to 1, and then we start over with I equal to 0 again. So we have A of 1 of 0, A of 2 of 0, and so on. So that is the order that the elements of A will be accessed. Now, how do we know if this is good locality or not? Well, we want these accesses to be as close together. We're looking for spatial locality in the array access, since there's not really, temporal locality is the same thing over and over. So, which would apply to sum is that's the same thing over and over. But as far as these array elements are, each of them is accessed exactly one time. So there's no repetition there. But they are, going to be near each other. But if we look at the address of A of 0 of 0 and A of 1 of 0, what we'll see is that actually their locations in memory are not right next to each other. Or they're not 4 bytes apart, as because ints are of size 4. But they're actually more than that. And, depending on how large this array is, what A of 0 and 0 and A of 1 of 0 is doing is going down, going down columns instead of going across the rows first. Again, this probably sounds familiar because we looked at this at the beginning of the course. So this is going down. And so each of these accesses of the array A, they're not right next to each other. They're a little bit separated depending on how big this array is. If it was a large array, there'd actually be pretty big spaces in between each access. So we would say this is not great. This is not good locality because there's a better way to do this. And you've seen before that there can be a pretty dramatic change in the speed of a program based on based on its locality, how well it exploits spatial locality. So we would say no. This is not optimal. This is not the best way to do this. Do you have questions about this? So this is something that should give you a great insight into how programs work, and is really, I think, the difference between folks like you who are studying computer science and really learning a lot about how these machines work, as opposed to someone, and there are, I think, a lot of people in this world who learn how to write code, probably because they want to be paid to write code. And so you can learn how to produce this computer code that does some things without necessarily knowing a whole lot about what does it really mean? What does it really do? How does that code, turn into a thing that the computer executes? The things that you've been learning here. Not everyone learns that. And I think that this is, knowing this stuff should give you an advantage. And let's talk about what that means. So if you can look at this code and have an idea of its locality, because you have an understanding of what this means and how it affects the computer, this is a skill that I think really sets you apart as someone with deep knowledge of computer science versus someone who just produces code without that much kind of depth of understanding about it. So, you can look at this code here, which is actually different from the previous one. So notice the two for loops, J and I. Now we have J is the inner for loop. So in this case, the array accesses are going to be A of 0 of 0, A of 0 of 1, etc. So it's going across the rows before incrementing the columns. So that is good locality. That is the optimal way to access these array elements. And so if you, as someone with an understanding of spatial locality, can look at these two little bits of code and see the difference in that one of them could be 5 or 10 times faster than the other one by making a tiny change, this makes you a far more sophisticated programmer and scientist So if you can walk up and make a to someone and make a tiny change in their code, I think a lot of people will be like, well, this code, this, these are two are exactly the same, but yours is five times faster. That should make you look real good. What do you think? Of course, you've sort of seen this example before. Let's take it a little bit further, something that's similar, but a little more involved. So if we have A as a 3D array, and we wanna get the best spatial locality from this program, well, what we're looking for is the reference pattern that our textbook calls stride one, which is the smallest, you know, if you think of a stride as sort of a step or a jump from one thing to the next in an array. So stride one is the smallest jump between each element, and that's just moving from one to the next. That's the optimal pattern going exactly in order through memory. So how can this 3D array be code be written optimally? What do you think? So what would we look at here? Oh, Mark has raised his hand. Mark, what do you got?
I would think stride one would be by Kij, but that's a guess.
So, well, wait, are you talking about this here? Be more specific, please.
Like the order of the loops?
Okay, yeah. So you would put what here?
K. And then I and J.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, so that's pretty good. How'd you come up with that?
In two-dimensional arrays, I would go IJ, which would be the row and then the column as the each column is a row, right?
Each column contains a row, sure, yeah.
So if you go through the row first and then to the next row, which is the element of the column. I don't know. I'm not explaining it very well.
But I see what you're, yeah, I see what you're getting at, and it's easy to it is hard to put in words. I'm also so let's and that's also for two dimensions. It's a lot easier to talk about columns and rows. Let's just look at here with three dimensions. It's like, well, what's a column and what's a row? But anyway, I mean, your answer is correct in that this inner for loop is really, that's what's gonna, you know, change the fastest if you think about it. Like the K changes all the time. The J only changes when we reach the end of the K's, and the I only changes when we reach the end of the J's. So if the K is the one changing the fastest, you know, those are our smallest steps, and we want the K to be this last element here. So you know, this is the last of the three dimensions in the three-dimensional array. So we want the inner loop to be that last one. I mean, similar to how in this case J was the inner loop, so that was the you know, the smallest access there. So since the J is you know, should in the innermost position here, we want J to be the array index here. Now, you could also address this a different way, and when you first said Kij, I wasn't sure what you're talking about. So you're talking about changing the for loops, and that's great. That is a good way to do it. Another way to do it is actually you could leave the for loops alone and just change what's written here. So if the for loops stay the same, then you would just want to put the K here where the J is. So and then you could put the J here and the I here, corresponding to, you know, outermost for loop, you know, outermost array element. So two different ways of accomplishing that. Either way, you're going to get the stride one pattern. So so your answer was good. And also there's another way to change it. So either way, we want to see that stride one pattern. So so yeah, that's good. And I also see in the chat window. David says reverse the arguments and the variables in the loops. Yeah, I think that's referring to what we were just talking about. So variables in the loops, I think what you mean is the array indices, which are represented by variables. So yeah, okay. So this sounds like y'all are thinking about this in the right way. What else you want to ask or say or whatever?
So how would the how would sum even look at this point? Because it's sum is an integer and it's being assigned values within an array or three different levels of an array. So would sum just be a three-digit integer?
Sum is not really anything unusual. Sum is, you know, I mean, it's a regular int starting at zero. And so the thing to consider here is that while this looks kind of fancy, this in the end, this just turns into a single int. You know, so there is, you know, this could be a 2 at position 000, and then at position 001, this could be a 4, which means we would now have 6 here in sum. Oh. So in the end, this is just a list of numbers. Right. I mean, we're treating it as a three-dimensional array, but when you do this access here, you're just grabbing one number out of this. You know, imagine, I don't know if I had the chocolate, if I had the board right here, I can't really draw a three-dimensional thing, but you know, there's just all these numbers in a, you know, we're considering it in this big two or three-dimensional space, but really it's just numbers laid out in memory, and we're grabbing those numbers, adding them up, and in the end sum just turns into, you know, whatever big number is the sum of all those things.
It's just a location pretty much.
Yeah, and so sum is a single int that represented by 4 bytes, and it's a single address in memory. And so it's updated with every add instruction. And of course, it'll actually live in a register while it's getting added, which is great because registers are nice and fast. Just regular old int because we're breaking this array. A is a fancy array, but we're just breaking it down into single ints. So good question. Just to sort of, we're thinking a lot about A here. Just because that's the array, but sum is really just a plain old number. So David says, could you help me visualize the column row explanation of this better by maybe sketching it out? Yes, the thing that I wish I could do. Well, first of all, drawing in three dimensions is definitely not something I'm particularly good at. There's probably some artists out there who would. But I mean, what I was doing, I mean, I do have paper here in front of me, so and maybe one of you could make a great illustration for this. I would love to see it.
Hey Matt.
Yes.
If you do the share button, there's actually a whiteboard that you can share and you can draw on. I've been using that to help people at the help desk.
In the help desk? Share, yeah.
There's okay. There's a whiteboard and you can share the whiteboard and you can use it like a dry erase board. It's a little
if I go to annotate. I
like
think
down
I have
at the bottom where it says where you hit where you're sharing your screen.
Yeah. Well,
if you click on the share button, for me when I click share, get like a I can get a whiteboard option.
Yeah. Well, okay, I see what you're saying. Let me play with that. It's a little confusing because I have more than one computer in front of me here. But I mean, I can actually draw stuff. You know, I can do all this right on top of the slide too. Of course, can I do this?
It's just tough
accurately
to draw sometimes, but that was just one thing that I used to show somebody how to do an array yesterday. I figured that might help you help people visualize.
Cool. Thanks. Appreciate it, Tarek. This is Tarek of Help Desk fame, who you all may know. Let's see if. So first of all, Mark has posted some link. Is that a good, should I open that link? Is that a good illustration? I think that, I mean, when we were talking about this array, we were talking about, you know, if we envision two dimensions here where we have, see how good I am at this. You know, I equal to zero here. Oh boy, this is rough. You know, one here, two here, etc. And then, am I doing this right here? No, we wanted I to be there. Ugh, okay, I already did it wrong. So we'll say this is J here and I here. Anyway, I'm not going to do this too much longer. But, you know, if this is in position 0, 0, you know, imagine coordinates, you know, 0, 1. I mean, we don't use commas, right? We use the array brackets. That's a real rough, you know, I need to get like a, you know, tablet or some sort of nice attachment for my computer here. But yeah, if I were better equipped, I could make an illustration, but I'm not going to pretend like even if I was well equipped, I would be a great visual artist. Let's see what Mark's link looks like. Okay, so I kind of like that. Let's see. See if we can put that up on the screen here. What's this going to look like? So this is Mark's link, like this. So, I mean, it makes it a little bit, yeah, I guess the things inside these cells here are actually the addresses, not the values. So 111, 112, of course, they're starting on 1 instead of starting on 0. Who, geeks for geeks, what kind of geeks are they if they start on 1 instead of 0? No, it's thank you, Mark. I will nitpick it a little bit. So I would call this 000 and 001, et cetera. But this is showing the addresses. So, you know, we still have to imagine that inside each of these cells is some different number, you know, and that what's written here is just the address. I have another question from Andres. So Matt, information is accessed faster by going column to column rather than going row to row, correct? So no, and I think we were mixing these up a little bit earlier. So we want to go, well, okay, let me think about it. I mean, we want to stay, okay, no, I think it is, no, you are correct. I think I just misinterpreted it. So we want to stay in row one until we've been through all the columns. So we call this row major ordering where, you know, across first and then down to the next row and across. So I think that is what you're saying. I'm used to thinking of it as what we call row major ordering, but yeah, you know, and the column first, and I guess another way to think of it is that, well, what if the array was only one dimension, you know, which is, you know, the array you're used to, which is 0, 1, 2, 3, et cetera. You know, in that case, you would want to go 0, 1, 2, 3. So yeah, I almost kind of start out at that, like, okay, let me just remember a one dimensional array. What's the best way through that? And then, you know, a two-dimensional array is really just the first row is an array, and then the second row is an array, et cetera. So yeah, the answer is yes, Andres. I think it took me a second to figure out, and that's why this row column naming thing can be a little hard to describe out loud. But yeah, I think what you're saying is right. And, you know, the real way to test this, besides doing a little experiment where we measure the speed, but a real way to test it would be like, you know, put this in the debugger and like look up the address of the first thing you're accessing and then look up the address of the next thing you're addressing. Like, are they right next to each other? You know, we can find out. And yes, we did talk about this way at the beginning of the semester. And I hope now, having had some more experience in GDB and, you know, C code and that sort of thing, you can look at this a little deeper. And Patrick says, is that only because we started off with the rows first? Well, yeah, and it's just because this is, you know, when you really get down to it, the reason is that, you know, the way the C language works and the way most languages work and the way the C compiler works is when you define this array, it lays it out in row major ordering. And then that means when you access it, you want to access it in row major ordering. Because you might say like, oh, well, why is it that way? And it's like, well, okay, so if you want to redesign a system where columns you know, column major ordering. And I think there actually probably were some like old programming languages that did this way. But, you know, you could have a system in which the columns, you know, you would go down instead of across. It is arbitrary, but in our case, and I think in most modern examples, row major is going to be the way. And so it's definitely the way in C and GCC, and I think other modern operating modern languages. So so yes, it's really how close those addresses are to each other is the key question. So I'm going to get this back on the slide. Thank you for the okay, so the battery's low on my microphone, but you hear me now, huh? Okay, so I'm going to try and make it through the next few minutes on my low battery, and then I'll change the batteries. Now I see why Dr. Hawk's always getting mad at me for batteries dying, and now I see why. So we're talking about memory hierarchy. So we have storage that's real big and real slow, like your hard drive. And we have storage that's real fast, but it's real small and real expensive. And that's like your RAM, and then below that your SRAM or your cache memory. And turns out that this works out well because while we have like a ton of stuff on your hard drive, you're only using a little bit of it at a time. And even of the stuff that's in memory, there's like a small amount of that that you're really using at one time, like your inner loop of your program or that one array that you're operating on. So we can make this hierarchy where we can have a ton of storage space, but we can that's slow, but we can have fast storage for the really important stuff. And if we do this right and our programs use locality right and we have good caching, then we can kind of have the best of both. So that brings us to caching. So I'm going to try and give you this illustration real quick from CS Illustrated. It's a nice little story about caches. So, and this uses a nice little metaphor, which is the library. So, you know, a big thing full of books, which even if you think is old fashioned, it's something you know about. So, let's see, here is our computer performing memory access. And our main memory here is a library with lots of stuff. It's big and it's organized. So in this library, you know, you can see things are in rows and they have addresses. Of course, being our computer library, we represent these in hexadecimal. So when our little orange guy gets sent to retrieve information at this address given here in hexadecimal once again, you know, this little guy is going to go through the library and find the right row and find the right shelf and go through the shelf and find the thing, which we'll represent as a book here. And then the little guy will take it home and do what he's got to do with it. So, you know, put it on his desk at home, right near home suite CPU. He's even got a little miniature shelf in next to his desk. And what we would do is we would call this little shelf next to his desk the cache. So the computer could go back and forth, or the little guy could go back to the library every single time there's a request for data. And, you know, that would take forever. You know, imagine, you know, you're reading a page of a book, and then when you run to read the next page, you go all the way back to the library to get the next page. No, you took the whole book home. So now, because the odds are, when you read one page in a book, you're probably going to want to read the next page in that book, not like some other random page in some other random book. Like, you tend to read these things in order, the same way our programs tend to go through, you know, arrays in order, tend to go through instructions in order. So this is actually is a metaphor that ends up working out really well. And so, you know, you'll take that book home from the library, keep it on the shelf next to your desk, and you can keep referring back to it. And so that's, you know, temporal locality in a way that, because you accessed it yesterday, there's a good chance you're going to access it today. And also spatial locality. If you read this page, you're likely to want to read the next page, which is next to it. And in fact, the way you've seen the library works, you know, next to that book on the library shelf is a book on the same topic, which you're more likely to want than a book on something completely different. So the library shows both of these elements of spatial and temporal locality pretty well. And I think it's an idea you're familiar with. So so I think it's a great illustration for us. And we will, well, I'll leave you with the last big idea, which is just the definition of a cache, which you can read about a little bit more in chapter 6. It's smaller and faster than the larger storage medium. And this is what makes our memory hierarchy work. It makes, you know, locality is what makes this work out. And it's how we can have a super fast processor, even though the things that supply the processor with instructions and data are so much slower. The principle of locality and the cache that we build around that idea make it all work together pretty well. So we can go into more detail soon, but that is the big idea of the cache and the memory hierarchy. And I look forward to your more questions and ideas and discussion on it, but that will be today's lecture. And of course, keep moving forward on Shell Lab, and we will be talking to y'all throughout the week about how that's going. So I'm free to chat about it more if you want to now or later. Thank you, folks. Let's see if I can.
I see a hand raised from Andres. Is that, you have something to say, Andres?
Oh, I think that was from the when I was saying that there was no sound. Sorry about that.
Okay. Yeah, I'm checking the chat and a bunch of people said no sound. So I don't know when my mic decided to turn off, but it's still on now. So thank you for getting my attention. It could have been a bummer. I'll have better batteries next time. This is still a lot better than the mic in my laptop, though. Trust me. Is audio working out well in your other classes? Oh, Krishna says the algorithms class goes into this. Cool. Great. That's good. And that's, you know, I mean, algorithms is often seen as like a very like kind of computer science theory class. And that is, but, you know, in systems is considered very like applied. And yet this is this principle here, you know, locality is a very like kind of theory idea, but in the cache is a very like hardware, like applied idea. And this is a place where theory and application like really go hand in hand. And this is where computer science shines, y'all. Like, you know, big ideas and real implementation all at once. It's like, you know, the big ideas of the mathematician and the implementation of the engineer. Computer scientists, are we mathematicians or are we engineers? On a good day, we're both. I'll leave you with that.